It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The small northwestern Wisconsin community, Lake Town, is trying to contain the pollution from CAFOs and create more accountability from concentrated animal feeding operations. The town is being sued for adopting local ordinances that target these farms with hundreds of livestock. Call in with your questions about CAFOs, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Adam Voskel is a staff attorney for Midwest Environmental Advocates. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me today.
Good morning. And John McCracken here is a Midwest Reporting Fellow for GRIST, which focuses on climate issues. And his recent piece profiled Lake Town and how it approached the CAFOs issue. John, welcome.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. John, let's start with you. Introduce us to Lake Town and how this community is seeking to regulate these large-scale livestock operations.
So Lake Town is, as you mentioned, it's the northwest corner. It's really close to the Minnesota border, about half an hour. Small community, about 1,000 people. And in recent years, they have, at the county level, Polk County in that area, attempted some CAFO, concentrated animal feeding operation, moratoriums to sort of pause the development or new ones in that area. But then at the local level in the town of Lake Town, they have adopted an operating ordinance that allows the town of Lake Town government and the board there to sort of monitor and set up guidelines and parameters for how these large agriculture operations do their operation, do their daily operations, and what goes on there too, with you know large amounts of cattle, or in this situation, it's a proposed hog farm,
a hog facility. Adam, I want to bring in you here. I mean, it says in the ordinance, Lake Town has a vulnerable landscape, shallow soils, high water table along the St. Croix River Valley. Why would it be the target of a lawsuit if it's trying to protect its natural features?
Yeah, so this kind of gets at a question that's been floating around for maybe 15 years, if not a bit longer. So in the early 2000s, the state passed what's called the Livestock Facility Siting Law. And that law, the regulations that implement that law are managed by the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And so while there has historically been a significant amount of authority and autonomy for towns to regulate CAFOs in agriculture, among other things, a question that was raised following the passage of that law was what authority or autonomy was rescinded, and what local governments could still do to kind of protect the health, the welfare, and kind of address concerns of local constituents to protect things like groundwater, which in certain parts of the state can be susceptible, really susceptible to contamination. So the reason that there's been pushback is the assertion from the residents that are being represented by an industry group in the state is that livestock facility siting law took away that autonomy, and the town has responded by saying no it didn't. That addresses the location of facilities, and instead we're here protecting the health and welfare by addressing the operations, how it's actually functioning, as John said, kind of on the day to day.
And that distinction is really important, I would imagine, John, to the town. I mean, the town rules are not prohibiting CAFOs. They're just putting in place really strict requirements for operations. Why is that an important distinction to make?
Well, that distinction, like Adam said, is happening. I don't want to speak for the town, but with the knowledge that this siting law exists, if they were concerned about an incoming operation or concerned about what it might do for groundwater or contamination in the area, it sort of is a way to preempt that by focusing on the operations, focusing on what daily operations are doing with spreading manure or containing it, or you know, what size or animal units they're getting to, and how they're sort of sustainably dealing with you know, a large amount of animals. But knowing that this Wisconsin state level law exists for zoning, for siting, then focusing on the daily operations again is a way for a community to sort of go into this without even, from their perspective, worrying about the zoning or the siting law, but again, focusing on those operations.
Talking about the regulation of CAFOs in Wisconsin with Grist reporter John McCracken and Midwest Environmental Advocate staff attorney Adam Voskel, you can join in along the way on CAFOs and developments in your own community, 800-642-1234. John, step back for a moment. How much do these large-scale animal facilities affect public health?
In recent years, we've seen this sort of, especially here in Wisconsin, this development of local citizens being more aware and concerned about the effects on public health. The main concern is usually, like I previously mentioned, manure runoff or manure contamination into local groundwater. You know, a large percentage of the state of Wisconsin is still on groundwater wells or private wells or things like that. And manure has a way of, you know, sort of seeping into that water table, seeping into the landscape. And when you have a lot of animals, you have a lot of manure, so there's a higher chance of pollution risk, or, you know, contamination risk. And as you had mentioned earlier, and Adam had talked about, the sort of nature of the landscape matters a lot, the type of soil and bedrock, if it's more, you know, susceptible to contamination, if it's, you know, coarse, or if it is has shale or things like that. So that biggest concern is always going to be the groundwater pollution from manure and things like nitrates and phosphorus getting into local either drinking water or recreating water. And if it gets in drinking water, it's not good for public health for people to be drinking those contaminants. Or if it gets into recreational waters, it is not good for, you know, things like wildlife and fish. And it has an adverse effect on the sort of biology of a water body of water.
And I wonder, Adam, you know, as we hear about the impacts of these facilities, is there a clear definition of what size of a farm operation constitutes a CAFO?
Yeah. So there is both a definition of an animal feeding operation, an AFO, and then a CAFO, or a large CAFO. And when we're typically thinking about these industrial, extremely large size farms that we're discussing today, there is a definitional term. It tends to vary based on the type of animal, but in Wisconsin, where we're typically dairy farms, you would think of 700 or more dairy cattle, about 1,000 beef steer, I want to say close to 2,000 hogs. It's generally a number defined by the amount of waste that the animals produce. And so they try to equal it out across the spectrum of potential livestock. But there is a definitional size in addition to being needed to be contained in inside for a certain number of days. You have to meet a threshold of, like I said, it's 1,000 animal units, and that animal unit is broken down by the type of animal.
John McCracken reporting on Lake Town. We also have attorney Adam Voskel with Midwest Environmental Advocates. Join in with questions about regulating CAFOs. Your thoughts on what ordinances have gone too far, what hasn't gone far enough? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A small community in the St. Croix Valley, Lake Town, along with some nearby towns, passed local laws last year regulating how CAFOs can operate in their communities. And now Lake Town is the target of a lawsuit challenging its local ordinance that make these concentrated animal feeding operations show how they deal with pollution. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, any point, 800-642-1234. We have attorney Adam Voskal with Midwest Environmental Advocates and John McCracken, journalist with Grist reporting on Lake Town. They stay with us. Let's bring in Katie in Monroe with a question. Katie, hi.
Hi. So in listening to your conversation, I've been in agriculture my entire life, and you guys don't really have a perspective of a producer. From a producer standpoint, on any type of farming, it's just like any other business. You have to scale so big to be able to make a profit. And then with today's world, we have people that are seven generations removed from a farm, and everyone wants a cheap, safe product. And so I guess my question is, how, as a producer, like, how are we supposed to do that?
Katie, thank you so much. Adam, go ahead. You first.
Sure. Thanks for the call and thanks for the question. I think the important thing to note here as it relates to the Lake Town ordinance is the fact that they're not banning banning CAFOs or banning a certain sized facility. And instead, what they're doing is recognizing in for some of these towns, you know, anywhere from a 31 to 50, 60 page fact-finding document, which simply outlined the susceptibility of contamination in the area. And so while, I recognize that there are sometimes concerns involved with, you know, making sure that these operations can turn a profit, I just, you know, it shouldn't be at the expense of the public health, the folks that live and rely on the resources of that community. And so this operations ordinance, to some extent, seeks to strike a balance both between allowing the operations to exist, but making sure that the community that would live adjacent to or neighboring those operations can continue to use, you know, their private drinking water wells, or as John noted, the surface waters in the area so they can recreate and safely. I think it's important just to recognize that this is not simply a ban, or it's not a ban at all. It is an attempt to ensure continued growth and continued thriving of the community.
John, did you encounter solutions in your reporting? Did things come up?
Yeah, definitely. I thank you, Katie, for calling in. I think that question sort of gets at the heart of this this lawsuit and this sort of divide, if per se, from, you know, communities concerned about contamination. And I definitely understand the perspective of a producer or someone who is wanting, you know, to keep the family operation going, and they have to scale up because agriculture and the industry is, as I wrote in the piece, there's been a large push in recent years for agriculture to sort of get bigger or get out. And that's concerning. I think in terms of solutions, we see places and farms attempting things like rotational grazing and cover crops and less impactive measures of waste in terms of, you know, farms that have maybe smaller animal units, but they have more focus on where that actual waste is going. I think it can get hard to sort of have a clear-cut solution when you have a very, very large amount of animal units. But on the flip side, as the caller mentioned, some farms are forced to have these large amount of hogs or cattle, et cetera, because it's the only way that they can sort of break even. So I think at the local level, you'll find maybe some environmental groups or, you know, UW Extension groups, soil protection groups that may have some more information about how to effectively manage that waste and where it goes, while also, you know, hopefully keeping the farm operation afloat.
Certainly. Competing pressures there. Let's bring in Kathleen in Steuben. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. We have a tragedy here in the waiting here in southwest Wisconsin where there's a proposed CAFO, a large hog CAFO that intends to spread about 2.5 million gallons of hog manure within 1/4 mile of the Kickapoo River. This proposed CAFO is on a ridge above where we live, and the Kickapoo River is our backyard, and we live in karst geology, and the local government is more or less tied between the farmers who are trying to still make a living and getting the tax credits that you can get for raising the crops and so on. But what can we get from the state government to protect our health and safety?
Kathleen, thank you for bringing that up. Adam, what are those steps? And can you also bring in right to farm law?
Sure. So I'm aware of the facility that we're discussing here. And so the steps that, you know, I know may not be wholly applicable, but, you know, when thinking about the state laws that address large CAFOs, you know, typically what you would look at is our state's permitting program, the Wisconsin Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or WPDES permit. Each CAFO as a point source under the Clean Water Act is required to seek and receive a permit from the Department of Natural Resources. Now, the hog CAFO that is being discussed in Crawford County in southwest Wisconsin has already received that permit. So it's a bit of a challenge, noting that is a means to address that concern. But certainly things like what we're seeing in Lake Town and operations ordinance may be a possibility for a local government that's looking to better protect the health and welfare of that community at a smaller scale. Looking towards the right to farm law, it's a bit different. The right to farm law addresses nuisance or private action suits. That's another state law that does kind of touch on agriculture and the withdrawal of autonomy of communities. And that right to farm law basically says if you are shielded from a nuisance action should a neighbor bring one, and the origin of that farm of that law was to prevent folks from the city moving out to the country and not liking agricultural smells, farms that smell, typical smells that you'll just experience in kind of rural life, and bringing some type of nuisance action to prevent them from operating. But what we've seen is the way that law is written, it actually it does much more than that. It says that if that there's no carve out for a change in circumstance. So let's say someone lives in a small farming community, and then one of these big operations just comes in across the street. Well, that's an exceptionally different circumstance, and suddenly you may your way of life may be threatened by things like the odor, the ammonium, the hydrogen sulfide that's being emitted by that farm, and you don't have a recourse through the courts. And if you were to try to use that law, what happens is should you lose, should that right to farm, that liability shield be successful, actually you're obligated, that community member is obligated to pay the attorney's fees of the opposing side. So we've seen that law in particular really be a hindrance to protecting communities in a similar way, not the same way, but in a similar way that we've seen that livestock facility siting law work as a hindrance to local governments and local communities trying to protect their interests and protect their way of life.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
Adam Voskal is an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates. And John McCracken is a Midwest Reporting Fellow for GRIST, focused on climate issues. And we have a link to his piece on Lake Town. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency about educating groups on how to reduce chloride pollution while keeping roads and parking lots, sidewalks safe. Our State Transportation Department's Highway Maintenance Bureau publishes this data-rich annual report on salt use. Last winter, Wisconsin spread nearly 388,000 tons, about 11 tons per lane mile. Join in with your questions on road salt, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brooke Oslison is Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Chloride Reduction Program Coordinator. Brooke, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So chloride pollution being your total focus, what measurable changes have your programs made on waterways in Minnesota?
Well, yeah, thanks for having me here to talk about this. This is a very important topic, and for Minnesota and Wisconsin and, you know, many other cold weather states. As you mentioned, we do use a fair amount of salt each winter, and that does get into our waterways. And the big noticeable result that we've really seen is that we've seen an increase in chloride in many of our surface waters across the state. In Minnesota, we currently have 54 of our surface waters that are above our state standard for chloride, which is designed to protect our freshwater fish and other organisms living in those lakes and streams and those wetlands.
So 54 above state standards, what are some things that Minnesota has adopted that is making a difference, you know, for environmental chloride reduction and cleanup?
I think that probably our most important and impactful measure that we have taken is our training program. We started a pilot training program actually back in 2006. And the goal of that initial pilot was to work with the private contractors to see if there were some actions, some easy things that they could do that would help maintain public safety, but also reducing the overall amount of salt being used. And over the years, that pilot program expanded. And now in the last few years, we've actually created a statewide training program, and we train thousands of winter maintenance professionals every year. And that has expanded to not only those private contractors, but as our state and our city winter maintenance professionals, as well as property managers and environmental professionals.
I'm wondering how you dispense that training. Is it virtual? Is it in person? How many hours?
Well, it used to be just in person. And then, of course, the pandemic had us all shift and do things a little differently. And so we did begin to offer them online. And now we do a little bit of both. So in the fall, we will have some of our partners who want to have an in-person training, maybe in their shop. And we have about a 5.5-hour training that then we would deliver in person, but we have continued to offer them online as well. That seems to be convenient for many folks, and so we actually are offering still through this month and February. We have several trainings on our training calendar and are working with professionals across our state and in other states as well. Since it's online, we do have a few folks from other states sneak in there.
So some people would say, why is training necessary if there is ice, black ice as well, you know, salt where there is ice, and that's that. What it needs to be more sophisticated about how salt is put down?
Well, that's a really great question. And really what we're trying to do is provide them with a wide range of tools and strategies that will allow them to be effective at maintaining that snow and ice, but minimizing the overall amount of salt that they're using. And so in some situations, salt may not always be the best tool for the job. When the pavement temperature gets very cold, so we say about 15 degrees or colder, the most common form of salt, sodium chloride, is actually not going to be very effective. And so it's not really going to provide the melting that is desired. And so understanding the science behind how salt works can be a really effective tool to make sure that we're not wasting any salt and that we're using the right product. There are some other products, calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, that will be more effective at those colder temperatures. But when it gets really cold, sometimes you just got to put some sand down for that temporary traction and wait for things to warm up before you can get out there and clear that snow and ice.
You mentioned sand, and Anissa in Black Creek would like to bring up sand as well. Anissa, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm from the Upper Peninsula part of Michigan, so pretty rural areas. And I didn't really grow up with salting of the roads or sidewalks. There was always sand being used. I'm curious if that's something we can do in central and southern Wisconsin more readily, then we wouldn't necessarily have the salt problem. I'm sure there's more to it, but I just am curious about that.
Anissa, thank you. What is the role of sand, Brooke?
Well, sand can be a really great tool for traction. I think that the main struggle with using salt is that it does actually melt the ice. And so it provides a little different level of service on that road or that parking lot. And so once the users are accustomed to that level of service, they kind of come to expect that, and their driving behaviors, come to expect that as well. And so I think in rural areas where we haven't yet changed kind of that expectation that there will be bare pavement or spots of bare pavement in the winter, using sand for traction is a great tool. Now, I will say that with sand, it is not without its environmental problems. Sand, of course, does get into our waterways and causes what we call turbidity issues. And so it kind of clouds up the water column and makes it more difficult for those fish to navigate and find food. It also can kind of start to fill in wetlands and lakes in particular if it gets deposited through a storm drain. And so it is not without its environmental impacts, but in some situation, yes, sand might be a better tool for the job, but we also have to make sure that those that are using those surfaces are aware that this is, we're not going to have bare pavement in this section of road and that you need to drive carefully. And for some areas, hopefully that will continue to work.
We're looking at efforts to reduce salt pollution with Brooke Oselson. She's the head of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Chloride Reduction Program. You can join in with your questions and how your community approaches icy roads, 800-642-1234. Brooke, what can people do at home to reduce their salt use on their own sidewalks, driveways, things like that?
Well, in most cases, really, you can cut back quite a bit on the amount of salt that's being used if you are using salt on your driveway or your sidewalk. We recommend about 1,000 square feet. You can use probably about a coffee mug of salt. And so it really doesn't take very much salt for it to do its job. And so it's really important to pay attention to what's in the product, because as I mentioned before, if those pavement temperatures are below 15 degrees, typical rock salt or sodium chloride is not going to be very effective. And so that wouldn't be the best tool. And also a good point for your listeners is that there is really no labeling requirements on bags of de-icer. And so they can list some of the ingredients, none of the ingredients. They can make a lot of statements on the bag that is not verified with anyone really. And so that is something to be mindful of, is that if you see a bag of salt with all of these claims that it's environmentally friendly, works down to minus 50 degrees, it might actually be too good to be true, because there is no labeling requirements across the country on bags of de-icer.
You've also brought up the idea of whether this de-icer is pet safe. What have you seen there?
Well, there are a lot of de-icers that do claim to be safe for pets. And as far as I have been able to find over my years, there is not actually a testing procedure to confirm that. So there isn't some organization that has a test that says, okay, if you meet these criteria, we will say that it's pet safe. And so those claims being made, I'm not sure what the reasoning might be for making those statements, but there really isn't a national test that we can rely on to confirm and have confidence that that is going to be safe for our pets. And so I just recommend keeping your pets off of all the de-icers and for sure, you know, cleaning those paws after they come in if they do come in contact with any de-icers.
Are there any strategies at home, again, as we're talking about use at home here for a moment, of putting down the de-icer? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, spreading it is, you know, is harder than it seems because you'll get a glop here and then a glop over there. How can you get a consistent coverage that isn't too much?
Well, one recommendation that we have is to use a spreader. So something that you might use for your fertilizer in the summer. You can use that same type of a handheld spreader. And you can actually measure the square footage of your driveway. And you can just draw a black, you know, line on there to show how much salt you need to cover the area. And then you can just use that to get a more even spread so that you don't have those clumps. And also to just, you know, really only need to salt those icy spots. And so putting salt on bare pavement really doesn't do a whole lot. And it's not necessarily going to provide future help because it's likely not going to be there for very much longer. Someone's going to walk over it, drive over it, and that salt's going to move anyway. And so we really do not recommend using any type of granular salt as like a preventative measure.
The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Brooke Osselson with us works to reduce chlorine pollution in our neighboring state. Colin, about your salting strategy, what you wonder about road salt applications, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of tons of salt poured on Wisconsin roads each winter. We hear from Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's efforts to balance that need for safe roads versus the risk of further damaging watersheds. Call in about road salt, what you're curious about with Minnesota's approach, 800-642-1234. Brooke Osselson is Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Chloride Reduction Program Coordinator and stays with us. Brooke, we heard from Michael in Green Bay called, and Michael wants to know if we're not using chloride alternatives because they're just too expensive, what is holding us back?
Well, yeah, that is a good point that those alternatives often can be more expensive than traditional rock salt. However, they also have negative environmental impacts. There's been some research over the last few years, and we have seen that they do create their own problems. And so I think that even if there was a product that was more affordable, that there still would be some negative environmental impacts. And so I think that just trying to, you know, connect with the users of our roads, our parking lots, our sidewalks, and help them to change their expectations or what they consider to look like safe conditions. Because I think what has happened over the years is people have gotten used to seeing a lot of salt on top of all those paved surfaces and now equate that to mean it must be safe. If they see all of this salt scattered all over the place, they have kind of a false sense of security and think that those surfaces are being well maintained. And I think part of the basis of our training program is really to help them understand that the winter maintenance professionals that That doesn't really mean, you know, that they put a lot of thought into what is the best tool or strategy for keeping that area safe. There are a lot of different tools, a lot of ways that we can achieve safety, but sometimes that public expectation and that public demand to see salt can create a situation where especially private contractors just have to come back and put more salt down. So I think helping the general public understand that there is a way to maintain our roads and our parking lots without creating unnecessary damage to the environment. It just might look a little different than what they're used to.
We need to adjust our expectations is what I'm hearing a bit there. You know, just to follow up, Kevin in Janesville called and wants to hear about the chemical alternatives that have emerged. Kevin brings up fluoride, beet juice. And here in Wisconsin, there was also an alternative idea of liquid cheese brine, things that have been come up over the past decade or so. Where is research at with these alternatives?
Well, the one alternative that has seemed to have the most promise from just kind of a winter maintenance perspective is potassium acetate. That is one that has come down slightly in price over the years. It's not nearly as corrosive as salt is on our infrastructure, and it is an effective de-icer. And so Minnesota's Department of Transportation actually did a research study a few years ago with a couple different universities to better understand what are the environmental impacts of potassium acetate. And we found, unfortunately, that the potassium side of potassium acetate is highly toxic to our freshwater insects and plants. Now, the acetate will break down over time. So that's where some of these alternatives might seem like a better option because they're not permanent. So chloride is a permanent pollutant. And so once we've introduced chloride into our waters, there's no way to remove it and it doesn't break down over time. Some of these alternatives will break down, but you mentioned cheese brine. Actually, there's an area in Minnesota that has a pickle factory that they use the pickle brine. Those have some salt in them. They still need to actually add salt to make them work as a de-icer. And that organic material actually creates problems in our waterways when it breaks down. So it actually depletes the oxygen from our freshwater systems. And so that can create a problem as well. And so right now, really the only alternative, beet juice, is one that does actually make the existing salt more effective and work at lower temperatures. And so what I have heard from those in the winter maintenance industry is that beet juice seems to be the one that they are using in small amounts because it can kind of gunk up their equipment too. It is a little bit thick. But that one actually does make the salt more effective. But all of those other products typically will still have, they need to have some type of de-icer in them. And most commonly it's going to be a chloride containing de-icer, but there are others out there.
Let's go to Phil now in Fitchburg. Phil, hi, what would you like to bring up?
Well, 2 points quickly. One is I realize that those fellows that are gals that are spreading salt on our highways have a difficult job and probably have been working long hours, maybe in the dark. I just think that we all ought to honor them by giving them a break and not following too closely or whatever. The second point that I would like to make is I have a driveway on a slope, and what I have found is that if I sprinkle salt on the upper section of the driveway, it not only will melt that ice, if appropriate, but it will also flow down the driveway as a liquid and continue to melt the ice on the bottom half of the driveway. So it's a way to economize as well as to limit the amount of salt that I'm using.
Oh, Phil, thank you for that tip. Brooke, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, and that's really what we need from not only the public, but from winter maintenance professionals, is just to look at what we're doing a little bit differently, to try to get a little creative, find some innovative ways to try to keep that surface safe and minimizing our salt use. And we have seen great success with that in Minnesota and well as Wisconsin from some of our winter maintenance professionals. And so that is a really great creative idea. Liquids is actually kind of the wave of the future in winter maintenance. A lot of organizations who are very proactive and on top of this will in many cases be using liquids. So that is the tool that is most effective for those private contractors, as well as our city and county and state winter maintenance organizations, because that is actually 23.3% salt and the rest is water. And so what you're doing is you're activating that salt. So salt by itself is not going to melt any ice. It needs to be in contact with water because it's actually changing the temperature at which that water freezes. And so by using liquids, you put it on, if you put it on before, that's called anti-icing. And that layer of liquid will stay there until it's kind of ready to go and activated. And it'll prevent that snow and ice from bonding with the pavement. And that's when we have the toughest time, is when that snow and ice has actually bonded with the pavement. It's really hard to remove that. And so liquids is really kind of the way of the future here for winter maintenance.
Does liquid require changing the trucks used or the type of equipment used?
Yes, it does require certain equipment. So you need to have brine. So you need to either purchase it from someone, or you need to have brine making equipment. And then you have to have tanks, of course, to store it, and then tanks in the truck that you can apply it. And then you have to have, spray nozzles on the back of your truck. But there are a lot of really creative ways for organizations, small and large, to implement a liquids program. And we have found that even with those upfront costs of replacing equipment, they save money within the first year or two, because they're using such less salt or such less product. And so they're actually able to save money for their organization by switching to liquids. And so it can have a cost benefit as well as an environmental benefit.
Peter in Amherst is here. Peter, hi, we're short on time. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. Important topic today. So I belong to the Isaac Walton League. And Brooke, I'm not sure if you've ever like to tell the listeners about the Salt Watch program. So through Isaac Walton National Program, you can go online, order a salt kit, and you can test your waterways. So if you have a pond in your nearby roadways and you're worried about salt, you can get a test kit. So I'd recommend people to go online, check it out, but that way you can enter the national database. And it's not about banning salt. It's kind of like what Brooke is talking about, but using alternative ways
to monitor,
using sand or brine.
Peter, thank you. Very quickly, Brooke, the salt kit approach.
Yeah, actually, we have partnered with the Isaac Walton League of America in the past, and we have many of our local partners, our watershed organizations, who have a partnership to utilize those kits to just help better understand what is the chloride situation in our waterways, where is it highest, what time of year is it highest, to just have some additional help out there looking for the problem and then hopefully coming up with creative ways to cut back on the salt in that area.
Brooke, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Brooke Oslison is Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Chloride Reduction Program Coordinator. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.